Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Circus Podcast, episode 81.
Eden Dachtuch.
That's a really bad pronunciation of Dutch.
Well, hey, everybody. We're catching you guys right at the beginning of June. It's been a very intense week, really, for everybody in New York and around the country.
Yeah, America is definitely going through a change.
Hopefully a positive one.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I was living in New York when the Black Lives Matter movement started back in 2015, 14. But I was living on 6th Avenue in Chelsea and I could see everyone marching up 6th Avenue. And last night we went to our roof in Brooklyn when we live right by the Barclays Center, which seems to be a hub for these protests in Brooklyn, and seeing, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people walking up Atlantic Avenue. Yeah, was quite moving.
And peacefully walking up.
Yeah.
I mean, I think what you will never get really from watching the news is what the energy of the protests are, and just being able to stand on our roof and look down at thousands of people who are marching peacefully for 40 minutes, I don't know, 30 or 40 minutes, however long it went, ending at Barclays Center, and then right at the curfew at 8 o'clock, everybody taking a knee and watching everybody stand up, thousands of people stand up after taking a knee. It was like one of those kinds of moments that just gives you shivers.
Yeah, I think, you know, and we had an NYPD helicopter right above us the whole time, and it was just a very, very surreal moment. I think, you know, like so much is going on in the world with this coronavirus and everyone kind of had their lives changed at the drop of a dime. And then we have this whole subsequent kind of issue happening out of that. And I think a lot of people's frustration and anger from just being locked up is then added to this movement, which I think is kind of cool because it's a way to put that energy into something positive, you know, and try to change something. But what's interesting is you see these articles about like the last time New York had a curfew, which was in 1943. And it was because a black man was shot by a white police officer.
A returning soldier from World War II.
And the riots started and looting and protesting and everyone was on curfew. And it makes me sad because it feels like nothing has really, doesn't feel like much has changed since then. But I hope that this does, you know what it did? It ignited a conversation that I think a lot of people are afraid to have. Because you're always afraid to say something wrong or say something offensive when you don't mean to. And it's nice because it opens the communication line of what do we do, you know, and what how do we talk about this issue, which people just don't want to talk about because it's uncomfortable and it's like scary.
You know, there's many, many smarter people than you and I who are talking much, much more eloquently about these topics. But I think what we can at least offer is a bit of a perspective on race and the circus. And, you know, while I was scrolling through the black images on Instagram yesterday, I follow this girl, Lola Pacaya, who I think we maybe reviewed her act on the podcast years ago. She used to be a Smarkus trooper. She's currently a student in university. And she had this great post talking about the whitewash racism that exists in P.T. Barnum's history, which I guess I knew, but I never thought about, really, or never confronted myself. So I messaged Lola being like, wow, this is really interesting what you're what you've written about on your Instagram. Like, what's the, like, where, how did you find, where's the, not to say source material, but like, where did you do this research from? What prompted it? And she figured this out as a 10th grader. You have a 10th grader talking about P.T. Barnum's business built off of racism and slavery, really. And if a 10th grader can figure it out, why people like you and I and people who are circus historians don't recognize it or don't talk about it or don't put really any meaningful emphasis on it is just an example of how, you know, we can be out of touch without really even realizing it. So I wanted to take this pre-show part of the podcast before we get into what I think is a great interview, essentially unrelated to today's topics, but still a very interesting interview, and take a moment to sort of deconstruct the P.T. Barnum history and legend.
Yeah.
And how race played into it, just so that, you know, those of you who are real circus people get a sense of what the eye opening that I got. Yeah, yesterday.
I think Ariel Emery posted on her Instagram a bit about this. She reposted Lola's. Okay, so she reposted Lola. So I also was interested by what Ariel posted because she felt like a lot of the circus community is maybe not talking about this or just continuing to just not totally address it. And I follow so many theater people and dance people. And I do feel like those two communities have really spoken very loudly about this issue. But, you know, the dance culture, especially urban dance, is built on hip hop, which is a historically Black community form of dance. And like to recognize that is very important. So I think it's a great topic that we're talking about, kind of like where the American circus was also founded by not just, you know, whitewashed history of people.
So let's just jump right into it. P.T. Barnum grew up in Bethel, Connecticut, which is actually pretty close to where I grew up in Connecticut. He was born in 1810. Which is prior to the American Civil War. So slavery still very much existed in the country. And he was a shopkeeper. He tried to do a lottery. He had many sort of like businesses and hustles he was trying to figure out. So Barnum's business success really starts when he's 25 in 1835. And a friend of his told him about a traveling act that was up for sale. And the act was a woman named Joyce Heth, who was advertised to be 160 years old and the former nursemaid of George Washington. Now, obviously, we know right there, she's not 160 years old. This woman was probably 60 or 70. And she was originally a slave from the South, owned by a man named R.W. Lindsay, who was an unsuccessful showman.
From Kentucky.
From Kentucky. And he sold Joyce Heth to P.T. Barnum for $1,000, half of which Barnum wasn't even his own money. He took out debt, $500, to get Joyce Heth.
But it was illegal to own a slave, so he had a loophole of basically leasing her.
Well, I understand that he bought her in Philadelphia, where the rules were still quite murky over what was allowed and not allowed.
And I think she also didn't, her status as a free woman was also confused.
And he toured this woman around the entire country, bringing in big crowds of people, basically saying, come look at this oddity. And, you know, a lot of the detail is lost because P.T. Barnum wrote his own biography and wrote a lot of newspaper articles. So, you know, all of the stories about him, he often has the ability to counter it in his own stories.
Or edit it.
But it seems pretty undeniable that she had a Joyce Heth, was probably an alcoholic. And while she was an alcoholic, he had her teeth removed in order to make her appear even older than she was. And at one point, he was making $1,500 a week. For weeks and weeks and weeks at a time. And he built his career. His very first success was this woman, Joyce Heth.
Also, horrifyingly, when she died, he also capitalized on that.
He did. When she died, he did a public autopsy in New York City at an amphitheater on Broadway. And 1,500 people came, paid 50 cents each, to watch a doctor take apart her body and proclaim actually she was only 80 years old. But prior to, you know, her death and autopsy, where she really succeeded as a marketing tool for him was in New York City. And after being in New York, they decided to tour the Northeast, which was interesting because the Northeast was the most anti-slavery and the most, you know, pro-abolition. And while he was able to pay off a lot of the writers in Providence and in Boston and Rhode Island, but not everybody could be bought off about Joyce Heth's act. A writer from the Boston Atlas declared, "A more indecent mode of raising money than by the exhibition of an old woman, Black or white, we can hardly imagine." So even people at the time were recognizing that there was something morally uncomfortable at the very minimum of how he was using money to promote this old Black slave who in many ways was functionally still his slave up until the point where she died. P.T. Barnum's use of Black people and African Americans as oddities, essentially, really did not stop with Joyce Heth. It essentially continued out throughout the rest of his career. One example of this was Barnum's tall person, somebody who was over 7 foot. It was called Madame Abma, who was a 7'9", as he described it, African goddess, who was just a Black slave from South Carolina. And he promoted her around the country, saying she was from Africa, painting her as a strange oddity. There's another attraction he promoted, with two black brothers known as Iko and Iko, who were kidnapped as children from the South and brought up to perform and do this act. He also used two black conjoined twins named Millie and Christine. And what's also just side note funny and horrible, the Greatest Showman movie very much whitewashes all of this to the point where they make some of these characters literally white and Asian, which is the definition of whitewashing. But
well, and then they have the one white black character who's Zendaya, and they have like the Rewrite the Stars song.
Well, they definitely rewrote the stars. One more, you know, thing I want to point out in the kinds of acts he promoted. He also had a group of deliberately unkempt slave, previously enslaved people who posed as the wild men of Borneo. So, you know, there's not a lot of detail to this, but it's not hard to imagine. You have these black men who are either currently slaves or recently freed slaves after the Civil War, who have, you know, no other option than to tour with the show. And if you've listened to any of our podcasts, particularly the one with Salaam, you learn a little bit about how racism existed backstage and how many performers, like the animals, were essentially enslaved by their inability to leave, and the only place they were getting fed and slept was at the circus. But basically, he deliberately kept these people, you know, looking and awful in order to keep them, the facade of them being these wild men from Borneo. And just to, you know, round out the picture of the kinds of ways P.T. Barnum exploited African Americans, when The Origin of Species, which is, you know, Darwin's book that sort of proposed evolution for the first time, came out, Barnum advertised William Henry Johnson, who was a microcephalic black man, as the connecting link between humans and apes. And, you know, microcephalacy, like, I don't really know a lot about the medical term, but it essentially means that not all of your body grows at the same rate. And I believe it includes your skull is smaller than the average. Basically used three black people besides this guy as this is the link between apes and humans, and just playing into racial, you know, stereotypes and the idea that black people were this uncivilized culture from Africa, and just exploiting that gap for money.
Mm-hmm. You know what's interesting that I was just thinking about? Like in theater history, you learn a lot about blackface and that whole time of vaudeville and
well, he certainly did minstrel shows as well.
Yeah, but you learn, like in theater history and classes, you learn about this entire period of time where people were doing this. And in a subsequent episode that we had just recorded with Jay Gilligan that will be released soon, we talk about the fact that there isn't really circus history classes like there are theater classes. And I wonder if that's also a part of the reason why the history of circus is kind of unknown, and there's no one really talks about this aspect of it and where it comes from and kind of like the cultures it was built on, in a way that you talk a lot about in theater and dance, I guess, as well.
You know, just to round out the strangeness of the story, and I do wish there was some kind of more easy way to access this history than by just digging up stuff online, is that P.T. Barnum switched sides from a Southern Democrat, so keep in mind Democrats who were pro-slavery at the time, to the newly formed political party, the Republicans, which were anti-slavery. And he ran for state legislature in Connecticut. And during many of those speeches, he publicly admitted to having slaves for a short period of time, and that he whipped them, and that he thought it was one of the most awful things he'd ever done. And he was very pro, well, very, who knows how pro, but he was in his speeches pro rights for African Americans. He ultimately did end up in the Connecticut state legislature. He considered running for president at one point unsuccessfully. But it does seem like, you know, when you look at his writing, the longer he lived for, the more he grew to regret and try to rewrite his stars, his past.
Oh, yeah.
And because he wrote his own autobiography, which he published multiple times, a number of historians have gone back and looked at the edits and how he shortened and rewrote the stories about Joyce Heth, particularly in his early career, as I think he even realized that his career was built off of this original sin, essentially.
Mm-hmm. It's too bad that The Greatest Showman was so...
literally whitewashed it.
Yeah, because it's such a... It could be such an interesting aspect to who P.T. Barnum was in a movie, you know? Like...
Well, I think to that point, Benjamin Reese was a professor of English and wrote this book called The Showman and the Slave, had this really nice quote, which is, The story of P.T. Barnum's life that we choose to tell is in part the story we choose to tell about American culture. We can choose to erase things or dance around touchy subjects and present a kind of good story, or we can use it as an opportunity to look at a very complex and troubling history that our culture has been grappling with for centuries. And I think that's what The Greatest Showman did, right? They presented the kind of good feeling story that we all accept. Barnum's greatest discovery was not really how easy it was to deceive the public, but how much the public enjoyed being deceived. People knew she wasn't actually 160 years old, you know, or that these people might not have been from Africa. But we all collectively like to imagine that's the case, and that imagine everything is okay and that we don't really have these problems. And just the public's more willing to accept a simple, happy story than, you know, the nuanced detail is, should come as no surprise. But I think the circus in general, and I'm certainly guilty of it, leans too quickly into saying that circus is inclusive, of course, because look at all the different acts that have been in circuses for millennia, black, white, Asian, male, female, short, tall. It's all about embracing diversity. But that's really only one side of the story. And I think often stopped the story there. And I don't, you know, I don't know more stories than P.T. Barnum, although I know there are hundreds of them out there, I am sure. But I think it's time for us, when we have the opportunity and we're talking about circus history, to really re-examine some of these things and, you know, make sure the story is told in a
cohesive
and detailed way, and not accidentally or purposefully brushed over for the sake of having a nicer, happier story to tell about our history.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's someone in one of those articles who I think wrote a whole thesis on this that maybe we should try to have on the podcast.
Yes, certainly. I mean, if anybody has stories like this besides P.T. Barnum, I would be interested in hearing them. So shoot us an email at hello@hideawaycircus, or send us a Facebook or Instagram message. You know, I'm no real expert, historical expert in this, but I'm more than happy to dig stuff up and try to do what we can on this podcast just to highlight important stories. And it doesn't necessarily even have to be about African Americans in America. I think it's just, if we're going to spend all this time talking to people about their careers and history, you know, we need to make the effort to do it in the most truthful and transparent and thoughtful, I guess, way.
Yeah. I mean, I think we even run the risk of having just a very specific view of our circus history, you know, and like where we were taught circus and what we've seen. And so I think it's a cool opportunity to really like indulge and diversify in the ideas of how all these different circus acts came to be and where they came from, and you know, like not neglect the origins of how we got to where we are.
Well put. Well, we'll wrap it there for now and do some kind of segue into our guest, who has nothing to do with race in America, but I think is actually one of the best guests we've had in a while. His name is Jeff Kreuter. He's a Tony Award-winning lighting designer. He's lit loads of Broadway shows, circuses, opera, dance, you name it, he's probably lit it. Jeff won a Tony for his lighting of Peter and the Starcatcher, which was on Broadway a couple of years ago. He recently lit our show, Beyond Babel. You know, for Lindsay and I, it was really a dream come true to work with Jeff. Not often do you make, I mean, maybe often you do make a list of who your dream collaborators are, but very, not often for us at least, do we manage to get to work with them. And I can't actually think of a lighting designer who I wanted to work with more than I wanted to work with Jeff. I saw his work on Big Apple. I saw it on Broadway. And he has this amazing artistic eye where not only he's able to use lighting to enhance the moment, he also just uses it in such a detailed way that is different on every project. I've seen him use loads of moving LED lights. I've seen him use super low budget static lights for a very quiet little play. And no matter what the version is, it's incredible how it supports the storytelling.
Well, I think what was really awesome for me working with Jeff, and we talk about it a little bit in the interview, but he's so careful and concerned and focused on the lighting helping tell story, not just being a secondary item. And like, why are we choosing this? What are we trying to say? what is the focus that the audience should be looking at? And through his guidance of lighting, I feel like the story really clarified. And that's what you want in a good collaborator and a good designer. And it was amazing because the lighting choice, the shades of light, the different times we used it, it just was quite incredible to see. And Jeff lit the show also with Sean Beach, who hopefully we'll have at some point because he comes from a different lighting point of view. He programs and designs. But with Jeff, he's just an amazing person. And I'm so thankful we got to work with him and talk with him.
Well, I hope that a lot of people who are also making their acts or their shows who are listening to this, even if you don't have the budget, or, you know, you're not necessarily that Jeff is working in, I think there's a lot you can learn about how to interact with a lighting designer and how to work with somebody to get the most out of your performance, whether it's just a performance within a show, because he does talk about what it's like just to talk to an artist who's in a circus show. And he also talks about what it's like to work with a director and sort of do the broader sense of it. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot that people can take away about the collaborative process.
Well, if you like our podcast, which I hope you do, please make sure to subscribe on iTunes, follow us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, Twitter tweet us, or email us at hello@hadawaycircus.com. Again, as Josh said, if you guys have any ideas about this topic that we were talking about today, send them over. It's awesome to read and get other people's points of view.
And if you're out there protesting peacefully, we support you. Make your voices heard. And in the meantime, enjoy our episode and interview with Jeff Carter. Jeff, I'm so excited to talk to you. We usually kick off the podcast by asking guests where they're from and how they got into the theater or circus world in the first place.
Great. Hi, guys. Nice to see you or hear you. I'm going to start over. I was born in Yonkers, New York. I grew up in Eastchester, New York. I went to high school there. I got into theater. So my parents were both heavily involved in the theater, in the local theater, and of all kinds. There were a few different local theaters. So they were very involved. And as a young child, I would be in and around the environment doing whatever I could to either help out or napping under a prop table, whatever was going on. And, acted a little bit. I think I was in Fiddler on the Roof and Guys and Dolls, and I played a Cratchit in Christmas Carol. Even up through junior high school, I was sort of in things here and there, and kind of decided that I didn't enjoy that, mostly because of the stage fright. I didn't enjoy standing in front of people and having to memorize words to have to say, because I could memorize things, but then when it actually came to standing in front of a group of people and saying those things, it was just petrifying to me. And even though I could do it, I felt foolish or just so nervous that I would forget what to do or stand there and like fidget. I don't know. You know, it was performing wasn't really for me. But except I was in a band or two in high school. So jumped to high school, I was in like a couple rock bands and thought that, you know, like that's something I might do with my life.
What was your instrument in the rock band?
I played the guitar in a rock band. You know, this was the 80s, so it was very like heavy metal kind of horrible music. Look back on this now, it's like, oh my god, that's not even music really. It's just like two fingers on a guitar calling it a chord. It doesn't count. I don't believe that that counts as music anymore.
What did your parents do in the theater?
My mother was an actress. And also for a time actually ran the local community theater. So, and my father, things behind the scenes. And actually he was in some shows too way back, but he did, you know, build scenery, did lights, and helped out in any way that he could. So that's what they're
called. So you really did have a real full introduction to the theater.
Absolutely. And my brother was also a musician, and he was and still is a drummer among many other things now, but then he would play the shows. If they did a musical, he would be the drummer for a lot of the shows, and I would do, you know, whatever. And at a certain point I started helping out with lighting. And then, when I was in high school, I decided that I needed to not spend my summer in East Chester, and I wanted to find something to do and sort of get out. And I took an internship. I did an internship at the Berkshire Theater Festival in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, and that changed my life. And that pointed me in this direction. I met some amazing people there, and kind of gravitated towards the lighting designers and loved what they were doing. I loved the mix of the need for like the technical aspect, technical knowledge, along with the artistic ability. Understanding what form and composition and shape is, but also knowing what equipment does. And it fed both sides of my brain, and I really enjoyed that.
So often with circus performers, we ask, like, was there an act or a show you saw at that time period in middle school or high school that was like, wow, I really want to do X? Was there a lighting look in a show or a show you remember being like, wow, that is so insanely beautiful? How do I get towards that?
I'm going to think about this because I've never been asked this question before. It's a great question. I know that there's an answer there somewhere, but nothing comes to mind. I will say that I started noticing lighting, though. I mean, I noticed what I thought good lighting was, what I thought, like, not bad. I don't think there's anything such thing as bad lighting. Oh, well, No, there is. But, lighting that doesn't, that misses opportunities. I mean, I think to me that's bad lighting. I mean, there's bad lighting, but there's also, like, missing an opportunity to design something, I think, is bad lighting. Non-choice to me. Well, you know, non-choice could be a choice, I guess. But, you know, like, not designing something to me is bad lighting. And I will say, okay, so... that summer, that same summer, we also got the opportunity to go to Jacob's Pillow and watch Modern Dance and up to other theater festivals. And I started like recognizing what lighting was and what beautiful work really could be. And I think I saw like the first play that I saw at that point, you know, on Broadway was Prelude to a Kiss, the Craig Lewis play. And beautifully lit. I remember noticing for the first time that I really enjoyed the design of the show. And up until that point, it never really occurred to me.
How old were you at this point?
This would be right before college.
Okay. So you kind of knew like what path you wanted to take prior to college.
I knew what path I wanted to take for a certain amount of time, for sure. I didn't exactly think I'd end up here now. I knew that that's what I wanted to do then. I knew that I enjoyed it. I knew that there was an opportunity. I saw people, there were mentors of mine that I met when I was 15, 16, 17 years old that I saw as professionals in the theater. Now, I didn't know if I wanted to be a lighting designer or a set designer or build scenery or hang lights. I wasn't quite sure where I fit, but I knew that somewhere in this realm was where I wanted to be.
Was there, you know, having been in a rock band, no moment where you were like, I want to be lighting U2 and, you know, that side of the lighting world where it's like concerts?
There really was never a moment when I was younger that I thought I wanted to do that. I don't know why. And I've done it. I've done concert lighting. I still don't. It doesn't speak to me the same way that that story lighting and storytelling. Not that concert lighting designers don't tell a story. I'm sure they do, but it's different, and it's not the kind of story that that I enjoy telling. Even circus lighting to me tells a story. I mean, it more so than just like rock, you know, music lighting. I'm probably gonna get all kinds of emails from rock and roll lighting designers.
I don't know how many rock and roll lighting designers, but for sure, circus people will agree with that. I mean, because we'll probably talk about this in the pre-show part of the interview, but certainly in Beyond Babel, which is the dance show that we just worked on together, which you lit along with
Sean Beach.
Thank you. I mean, the lighting is one of the main storytelling devices, as there's essentially, you know, very little set or even costumes are very basic. But jumping back to sort of your origins, how did you go from just being an interested college student interning to somebody who's actually starting to get shows on their resume and get gigs? And
it built on it slowly at first, like just, you know, built up, and I didn't, it was so gradual, and I never really thought, I really truly never thought I would still be doing this after the age of 30. But it started when, it started that summer. I met, at the Berkshire Theater Festival, Jeff Davis was the resident lighting designer. And, soon after that summer, he became the lighting designer for New York City Opera. He took the job as a resident designer for City Opera, and they were, you know, obviously a huge company back then. Now I don't know that they even exist anymore. And if they do, it's very small. But they were a major opera company in the world. And there was something called the Gilbert Hemsley internship, the lighting internship. So through college, so I went to SUNY Purchase College, to study design and focus on lighting design. I went there specifically to study with the two people who were teaching lighting at that school, Billy Mincer and Brian McDevitt. And I remember like halfway through, I think at the end of my sophomore year, I was going to take a leave of absence because I thought like, this is really focused. Like it was a very focused program. And I was like, I'm not sure I want to like do this. And I feel like maybe I just want to go like chill out for a year. And I had all the papers signed, like ready to go. And then like two things happened. One, I had to get my advisor to sign the paper. Billy Mincer was my advisor. And I found him in the hallway and I said, listen, I'm going to take a year off. Can you like sign this? I want to come back. Can I come back? He said, you're making a mistake. Don't go. He said, you're good at this. If you leave, you may not come back. And I think that would be a mistake. You should pursue this. And then he said the words to me that like, you know, it's still to this day, it's what we want to hear. You know, at that point I was at the end of my sophomore year and, you weren't promised like to design anything at school until you were a senior. And he said, if you come back next semester, we'll give you a show to design. So I was like, oh, wow. Okay. So I think about this. And then like 30 seconds later, my phone rang and it was a very close friend of mine named Ed Hoffman, who I'm still friendly with. And he said, a great room opened up in our apartment. Do you want to move in with us next semester? And I was like, ah, shit, I'm coming back. And that was it. So I stayed. So I stayed in school. All you kids, stay in school. I was actually going to go. I wasn't leaving college. I was going to go. I was transferring to Miami of Ohio. Mm-hmm. I was really ready to go.
That's where my sorority was founded. If you care.
Fun fact.
It's a beautiful campus. Yeah. I visited it. I was like, really? I like put a lot of thought into this.
Why did you want to go there?
Oh, yeah. A little blip here. Again, my parents, so I grew up in East Chester, but a year into my being in school, I purchased my parents and the entire rest of my family moved to Cincinnati, Ohio.
Mm.
So instead of like me leaving the family to go away to college, the family left me at college. So I was, you know, maybe I was homesick. I don't know. I was going to go to be closer to them. I don't know. I don't know why. The only explanation I have for why that school is because it was not far from where my parents were, and I could get in there also, I think. they would have me. Okay. I stayed in school. Okay. So, right. So then I heard about, so let's cut to,
well, what was the show that they let you light?
Yeah, it was a one act festival, two plays by Richard Greenberg and two plays by John Patrick Shanley.
Cool.
Of course, like as a, yeah, really
very
cool.
Moody.
Very moody, but also as like a sophomore and junior in college, I didn't know who these guys were, you know, right. Richard Greenberg and John Patrick Shanley. Now, like looking back, like they are actually two of my favorite playwrights. And it wasn't until years later that I realized kind of how, like, I don't know, that evening 1X did a lot for me as an artist, as not so much as a lighting design artist, but as someone who can read a play and interpret what the play needs from design and tell a story using lighting and using design. It was a great opportunity for me, just like at that point in my life, to sink my teeth into something. I learned so much.
Also, do you feel like play, to me, when I watch a play versus a musical, a play almost needs the lighting to support it in a way more than a musical, because a musical has so much going on with the dancing and the singing and you know, there's so many other elements supporting the narrative, not just, you know, the text and the visuals. And with a play, it's like you have the text and then it's like, okay, you have to then build this whole world with a little bit less than you have with a musical.
Yeah. You know, each play is different. Like, you know, there are plays that need more from lighting and plays that need less. There are plays that I've done plays that take place in one living room over the course of 3 hours.
Right.
And while the lighting is super important, I don't think the audience ever knows the difference, even though I do. I mean, and the director does and the actors do. But it's super subtle. And I feel like there are musicals that don't have any scenery that need lighting to define place and time in a way that some musicals don't. Like Falsettos, I did the revival of Falsettos on Broadway a couple of years ago, and it was a big, you know, blue box that surrounded the show with nothing else. There was no, you know, lighting did all the work in defining space.
Pulling from an example we saw of yours as a play, we saw you do a David Mamet one act at Atlantic at their second stage. I forget the name of the show.
Ghost.
It was two one acts, or three.
Took place on a train, and obviously this is a tiny little 99 seat theater, and the lighting was basically the only way we got the motion of the train, because through the window you sort of had that feeling of motion.
Hours and hours of work to do that. I mean, like every day we would, you know, I would come in. I was there for 2 weeks. Every day we would come in and try something different until we were like, okay, finally. Like, and not even finally. Finally, we were like, we're just going to live with this. It's good.
Well, it felt very believable as an audience member.
Fortunately, working for someplace like the Atlantic, they give you not only time but support. And there were the electricians that we were working with there didn't. Like when I, you know, every time I walked in every day and say, let's spend 10 minutes a day working on the windows, they weren't, you know, they didn't have it. You know, they, what am I trying to say? They were supportive and didn't think I was nuts. And they, I think, certainly the people, and I'm not sure who's doing it now, but the people who were production managers and electricians at the Atlantic back then were game for anything and kind of lived for that sort of thing. They liked the exploration. That's, you know, that's why I like working there.
That's actually a good segue into a question I wanted to ask in this podcast, which is if you could sort of break down a little bit what a general process is from you being taken, saying, yes, we want you on the project, Jeff, and you accepting it through to the show is lit. You know, I think there are many people who are listening to this, who just spend their whole, you know, career and time focusing on getting their act, or maybe they're writing a whole length of a show, but don't really learn, definitely in circus school, it's not like theater school, you don't learn how sound and lighting works in circus school. You spend all that time doing contortion. So I'm hoping we can shed some light on how that process is, so that when people do go and make their own shows, they kind of have a sense of what's possible and how it works.
Sure. I spent plenty of time on special contortion, although it's not quite. Yes. So, okay. So I have done an hour on this question, so I'm going to like try to like not do that this time, but truly like that, this has been the topic of a full podcast hour. And I have a whole like lesson. If anybody out there wants to hire me to teach the lesson, my phone number is.
you can email us and then we'll connect you with Jeff.
Great.
If you're legit.
Great. Okay. So the Cliff Notes version of what a lighting designer does and when the process. Okay. Number one, I either read the play, or in the case of something that doesn't have words, look at it, look at what it is, either in video and or speak with the creator of what that is. And in dance, I will, before I even see a piece, I'll spend a lot of time just talking to the choreographer about the vision of what he or she is trying to do. And there's one, Jennifer Muller in the Works is a dance company I've worked with for now 25 years. And I love that meeting with Jennifer Muller in her studio once a year, where she's telling me about her new piece, and she grabs like a piece of like lined paper and she'll start just drawing things all over the place, you know, just sketching, you know, what, where things might happen on, you know, on this part of the stage. Anyway, so it's really, for me, it's, I love, it's ground up. I love being a part of the conception, even the work that I do with Penn and Teller. And you know, it doesn't happen as often, as it did when I first started working with them. But there were a few times when I was out there in Vegas, just like I had not, I wasn't invited to speak in the conversation at that point. I didn't want to speak, but to sit there and watch these two geniuses go back and forth with some like idea for the new opening of the show, to me, like, told me so much of what I needed to know about what, how it would be lit or could be lit. I don't think we ever, like, that. There was one meeting in particular. I think it started at 2 o'clock in the morning, my time. So like, you know, so I flew out there, they did their show. They sign autographs after the show. After every show, they sign autographs for 45 minutes to an hour until the last fan leaves. And then we had a design meeting. So, and I just got off an airplane. So I was like, you know, completely exhausted, but just sitting there, you know, it was an amazing conversation. Anyway, so, okay. So it starts with the work. It starts with either the play or the act or what the context is. And then, and I mentioned this before, it's storytelling. Light is another way to build blocks in storytelling. And I then try to figure out how I can help, like what aspect of my contribution could help the performer or the playwright and the director convey something to an audience, because also at the end of the day, that's our job. I think our job as presenters, whether you're a designer, a performer, a director, we're giving it to people who are watching it. And man, it's crazy to me how many people don't remember that and understand that we're all doing this for an audience. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, hopefully people are entertained or moved so it's my job is to help the performer or help the act do that, help you know, make the audience either have fun or be scared or, you know, feel. I'm a feeling generator. So then we start talking about the nitty gritty, like, is there a set? What is that set? Where's the set going to be? What's it going to do? How does light play with the set? And you know, the process sort of rolls on from there.
When does the technical aspect come in, where you're picking what the actual lighting fixtures are and where they're placed, and how do you turn the artistic concept in your head into the practical technical elements?
You know, when I read in the case of a play or a musical, when I read it, I have a sense of what that equipment will be without knowing exactly what it is. There's something in my mind that helps me paint a picture of the style. And once I figure out what it is stylistically, I'll know what type of equipment to use. When I was working with the circus,
Big Apple Circus,
the Big Apple Circus.
And this was when it was a nonprofit.
No, this was the first year after, right?
First year, right. This is the first year after it came back. First and second year. I did their first 2 years after the rebirth of the Big Apple Circus. And it was awesome. Actually, I had a great time working with them. And then I don't know. Then the Big Apple Circus changed again. And I don't know what happened with them.
Still changing.
It's a whole other podcast, I think.
Well, yeah, you can go back through our backlog, Jeff, if you're bored. We have a few going through the history
of the Big Apple Circus.
So yeah, that's a great example of it. So you know what the acts are probably beforehand, and you know what your rig is. You know you have four king poles. You know you have this truss that's in the tent.
Yeah. But, you know, for what's so, yes, four king poles and a cupola truss, and one might think that the lighting would hang in the same place every year that they do a circus. In fact, I think, you know, I didn't do this past season in the tent, and my understanding is that they basically stole the light plot that we were using the year before and didn't use it very well. Don't edit that out. So, but, you know, the fact is, like, I did it 2 years in a row. The light plots were completely different for a variety of reasons. One, the show's there. I mean, it was a different theme. So the lights have to reflect what the theme of the show is. And I will say that, the light plot the year before I did the circus was completely different from what it was when I did it. Partly because I wouldn't, as an artist, take someone else's design and use it. Even though I spoke to the guy who did it, and he was like, just hang the light. Just, you know, if you want to, like, do yourself a favor, just, like, use my light plot. And I was like, no. And he's afraid, we talked about, because I called him, once I got hired, I called him and several other people to ask what their experience was and how they enjoyed working with the circus. And, you know, it's different in that, yes, there are four poles and a truss above, and you can't put lights where you really want to put lights. You put lights where you get to put them. Now, fortunately, I spent 2 summers doing Shakespeare in the Park, which is similar because you're out of your comfort zone there also. You can only put lights where the poles are.
What shows did you light for them?
I did Much Ado About Nothing, Comedy of Errors, King Lear, and the musical Love's Labor's Lost, Alex Timber.
Oh, cool.
Love's Labor's Lost.
Yeah, that is similar in a way.
In my first show in the park was kind of like petrified. It was absolutely petrifying. It was out of my comfort zone completely. You know, also you can't work during the day. You know, sleeping all night, working during the day. My wife Kate has this great story of like day two at, I think it was like 10 a.m. I'm in bed in a dark room having worked all night, and she opened the door and peeked in, and I was just under the covers, and I opened my eyes and I said, I can't do this. This is, how does anyone do this?
Yeah.
And then I did a whole other summer. So I figured it out. You figure it out. That was the second day of my first summer working with Dan Sullivan as the director, who I'd never worked with before. And you know, I wanted to do great. I wanted to do really good work, and it was totally stressful. But it worked out.
But played somehow to your Big Apple experience. And I was also just in talking a little bit about how that process worked. Was it, maybe it was Mark Lonergan who was directing, but did you find that most of your interaction was with Mark, or was it mostly with the performers on stage who were saying, that light's in my eyes while I'm juggling? Or how did the collaborative element work?
Sure. I don't know why this was at the circus, and maybe this is like this at all circuses, but as soon as I got hired, I said, Mark, let's talk. Like, I want to speak to the acts. Like, I want to know like what they're trying to do so that I can help. Just as we were saying before, what story are they telling? How do they want to, like, what story do they want? And Mark was like, that's a great idea. That doesn't happen for some reason, but let's figure this out. And man, it was really hard, actually. And half of the acts I spoke to ahead of time, the first year, half of them were interested in speaking to me about lighting. And I would say half, like, didn't have anything to say ahead of time. But here's what I will say. Like, getting into that tent, and like, we're skipping a whole chunk of the story, like, you know, hanging the lights and figuring out where the lights go. But getting to tech rehearsal, like, you know, I would go visit everyone during rehearsal and meet every act well in advance of actually turning a single light on, just to talk about what their act was and what they wanted to do. And then when it came time to actually doing it, standing in the ring, everyone that first year and the second year, both years with Big Apple, all of the acts were totally into it. And like lighting to them, whether they were able to speak about it ahead of time or not, was hugely important. And not just like, that light's in my eyes, do something about it. Now, there was a lot of that, of course. And that's fine. And, you know, that's part of my job, is to make sure that someone juggling can actually see what they're juggling. And I would stand in the ring and, like, you know, I'm not really a good juggler, at really. But I would stand there holding, you know, like to look up and, you know, like stand next to the person trying to juggle someone, or stand next to the person trying to balance on a ladder 20 feet in the air and be like, oh yeah, like, of course you can't do this. That light's right in your eyes. What can we do? And, you know, there were points where, you know, I was, you know, my second year at Big Apple, I was doing I was doing something else in New York at the same time. I don't even know. I can't remember what it was. A musical. And I was going back and forth. And one day, I didn't even know this happened. One of the jugglers and my assistant had to relight a piece of an act. And I watched it that night and I was like, why does it look like someone turned the work lights on and pointed them at the top of the tent? And my assistant said, well, they couldn't see the balls and they wanted more light up there. I was like, oh, great. So we turned the work lights on. Great. So why don't, okay, stop. Everyone stop. Like, how do we do this and make it look good? Because there's a way to do both. And that's what my experience with Big Apple taught me, that there's a way to make everyone look good. Make it functionable, let everyone actually be able to do their act without getting killed, and also have it be really pretty or, you know, something, you know, beautiful.
Effective.
Yeah.
Effective. Yeah. And lights, you know, lights are hard for these performers. Lights are getting brighter and brighter and brighter. You know, the world of lighting design, it's not getting darker. Like, the audience wants it brighter. HD TVs means everything's brighter, brighter, brighter. These LED lights are so much harder to look into for a performer than the old school just incandescent fixture. And it's a balance. It's a balance of getting used to it. And it's building up. It's starting, you know, maybe in tech we start one way and, you know, 4 days later I'll go down to the person who's on roller skates with his wife, you know, on roller skates with, like, you know, him spinning her around with something in his mouth, or, you know, that act,
yep, sure.
You know, to be like, all right, like, we've done it a few times. So is the light bothering you? Can I add something else? Can we add some flashes? You know? And so it goes from there. You know, some performers will say, like, no flashing lights. And then they'll come up to me and be like, hey, I like the way that act looks with all the flashing lights. Can we do that for my act? And it's like, well, yes. Can you do your act? You said no flashing lights. I'm happy to do something fancy, but am I going to, like, ruin you? And you're like, no, I can do this. And then, like, high wire, like, for, you know, like, working with Nick.
Willenda.
God.
Yes.
How do I forget Nick, the last name, Willenda. Nick, that was crazy. It just, like, exited my mind. Nick Willenda. So, you know, that was a team of, I forgot what the pyramid was, 12 or 16 people. Oh.
Seven.
Well, let's say 16, but in Big Apple, I think it was a seven person.
Only really seven people? God.
Two,
so
two, two, one.
Yeah, it's
four
seven,
on the ground,
yeah.
Two, one.
And our friend Eric Allen was one of the yes. Middle. And I was like, oh no.
It's 25 people.
Yeah, 25 person pyramid.
So, you know, there were varying degrees of comfort for those people on the high wire. And, you know, it was very important that while they were up there doing anything, the lights did not change. Like, nothing could happen with the lights. Like, one look, keep it. And that's how we started. And by, like, week two, we were following them across the pair, like, the wire with moving lights. And getting, Sean Beach actually programmed that show. He worked with me on that show. And when at one point, like, they were up there doing a high wire thing, and I wanted to change something that was lighting the tent, like, behind them. And I was like, can we take, like, fixture seven, like, move it over a little bit? And I remember, like, he picked his hands up, put them toward the console, and, like, was about to touch buttons and looked at me like, I'm not while they're up there. We really shouldn't touch anything right now. It's like, all right, fair. Fair. I don't want to be the one to make, you know, seven or 24 right. people.
The Willendas fall again because of Jeff Kreuter.
Because of Sean Beach. Sean right. Beach. Because of Jeff Kreuter and Sean Beach.
It's interesting.
So, but what I was going to say was, all the people from the pyramid would come down and it would just be Nick up there doing something. And, you know, I would be like, oh, well, we can't do anything because Nick's up there. He heard us at one point say that. And he was like, you can do whatever you want. I live up here. Like
you the other people,
you can turn them off. Like, I don't care. You're not going to knock you. You and your lighting are not going to knock me off this wire. Okay.
Yes. There's, I met a guy, a Chinese acrobat who did tight wire, who from the age of 8 or 9, when he started training it in China, was not forced or was required to eat his breakfast, lunch and dinner on the wire. So he would just, he'd just live on it, you know, naturally always there.
Yeah.
But you know,
I'd say this, the same thing with the flying act. Both years I did Big Apple. I forgot his name now. It's horrible.
It's okay. The guy does a triple. It's crazy. We talked about it.
Family.
We'll link it in the bio.
He was spectacular. Also, like, and a star. Like, you can just see, like, the guy is a star in the making, or maybe he's a star. But he could do anything up there in the air with the lights, doing anything at all. Did not matter. We could do, he said, like, do whatever you want. Whatever you want to do while I'm flying is fine. Maybe not so much for everyone else, but for me, like, go to town.
Yeah, that act was crazy. But I had a question because we were talking about, you know, contemporary circus acts and in schools versus more traditional circus acts.
The Big Apple being more the traditional side of that spectrum.
And you know, in contemporary circus, especially at school, I think the students really focus on storytelling in their act and music choice as a really specific way to tell their story. But when we were just talking to our friend Book Kennison on the like a few podcasts ago, he was like getting into the music and creating his own music for his act. He's like, maybe the next thing would be lighting. And I don't know if actually many circus acts really take the time to think about the lighting that can add to their act versus like music.
And just to piggyback off of that point and then let you answer it, I think one of the things that also makes circus performers a little different from actors is circus performers have like 25% playwright in them, you know, where they're, you know, structuring their acts and thinking about what it will look like from the audience point of view.
I'll say the same thing that I said to playwrights when I taught lighting appreciation class at NYU. It meant, like, think about it. It makes a difference.
Yeah.
And I got to say, like, every act that I worked with at Big Apple, if they didn't think about lighting when we started the process, they absolutely did by the end of it. And I made sure that they thought about it and had something to say to me about it. And even if that was, like, this light's too bright or, you know, why, like, you know, yeah, like one random performer wasn't even, he was like a performer in an act and wasn't even like the head person in the act, walked up to me one day and asked me why I made a section of the act blue or turquoise. And I was like, well, that's a great question. We've like talked about color theory for a while. So it's to the performers putting an act together, Think about lighting the same way you think about costumes. Think about lighting the same way you think about the color of whatever you're holding. It matters. And then hopefully be able to have a conversation with people, with your lighting designer. Because if you want, you know, and you know what, actually, maybe I'm wrong about this. Cause now that I think about it, there were a couple of performers who said to me that they appreciate that I showed interest in what they were doing. So maybe not all circus lighting designers are interested in what the performer has to say.
But everyone's different, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the number one thing people are used to, circus performers wise, is the note, oh, come on, that's in my eyes, more than it's, you know, like I would like it to evoke, feeling.
But also depends, you know, again, like the difference between a more traditional show, which is like Big Apple, where it's act, 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 with no real, you know, there's a theme maybe, but no real like story. And then there's like the contemporary where you have like a Seven Fingers side of it where it's really story driven in a way.
Or like,
you know,
Daniel, I don't know if you know the director, Daniel Finzi-Pasca, who does a lot of opera.
I don't.
But he does a lot of circus as well.
Yeah.
But I'm, you know, you were talking a little bit about Penn and Teller in Las Vegas.
Well, hold on.
Do you have a question?
First question though, because I'm like, how the heck did he get from... Okay, sophomore year, we're going to leave to, now we're doing Broadway.
Yeah. Okay, right. Okay, so, all right. So,
we'll
Jeff Davis. So, right, so now we're moving back to Jeff Davis, where everything fell apart before.
Yeah.
He took a job at New York City Opera. They had this internship called the Hemsley Internship. I stayed in touch with Jeff through college. When I got to my last year of college, he said, you should apply for this internship. And not only apply, but come visit us at New York City Opera as often as you can, because if everyone who makes the decision about this internship sees that you like care and you really want to do it and you're investing the time, then it'll give you you'll have a better chance of actually getting the internship. The internship is still around today. I mean, they do it. It's changed vastly, partly because City Opera doesn't exist anymore. But they chose me to do it. So graduating from college, I moved to New York City, had a paid internship at Lincoln Center, and was able at that time with two other people afford to live in Greenwich Village. This is like 1990, I don't want to say because I'm old, but 1990, a while ago, early 90s. It was not a very nice apartment, and three of us lived in what one person might consider not livable for one person, but it was ours. It was home. The roaches outnumbered us by many. It was a great way to start. And so that was it. So that's how it all began. I did this internship, met tons of lighting designers who came through, like some of the greats who came through and lit shows for City Opera, and got to sit at a tech table next to some of the best people at the time who did lighting for a living. Finished that. I'm going to travel back in time for a moment. The lighting designer, Ken Posner, who is a Broadway, among other things, lighting designer, multi-Tony nominee. I think he's won also. But what's impressive is not how many he's won, it's how many he's been nominated for, which to me is impressive. He was involved with that same community theater that my parents were involved with back in the day. Now he's older than me. And I knew him back then. And maybe I helped him hang a couple of lights, but when I was finishing school and then finishing his internship, I reached back out to him and he hired me to be his assistant. I might have this timeline wrong slightly, but the gist of it is that I assisted him for a number of years and many other people. So I started as an assistant designer in New York and as an associate designer, and I would design really tiny plays and really weird performance art projects and dance, tons and tons of dance, like modern dance, ballet, anytime I could.
Do you remember what the first show you did with him was as assistant?
With Ken Posner?
Yeah.
I absolutely do, actually. Did I ever tell you the story? Is that
no.
why you're asking
me? I don't know.
Oh, my God. Okay. So the first show I did with him was called Sophistry by Jonathan Mark Sherman, starring Ethan Hawke and Steve Zahn and Anthony Rapp. And,
wow.
And Jonathan Mark Sherman was in it, and man, there were other people in this too. But that's the gist. So that was my first show assisting in like my first play in New York as an assistant. And I met Jonathan Mark Sherman, playwright, who I don't know if you remember this, but am I lying about this? Yeah, while I was doing Beyond Babel, I was doing kind of at the same time a musical written by Jonathan Mark Sherman.
At
the New Group.
Yes.
Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice.
Yes.
Which, like Beyond Babel, had to close its doors recently. Unlike Beyond Babel, will not be coming back. Beyond Babel will be coming back.
Most definitely.
Yes.
Met Jonathan Mark Sherman. About a year later, he was involved in a one-act play festival at the Workhouse Theater in Soho, that does not exist anymore. I think it became The Flea for a while. That same building turned into The Flea, which now is, I think it's still somewhere else. Jonathan had met me. The director of those shows, there were two directors, Elizabeth Holder and Lizzie Gottlieb. They were looking for a lighting designer. Jonathan Mark Sherman was like, there's this guy, Jeff Kreuter, who was the assistant on my play. Talked to him. They did. They hired me for that. It went really well. All had a great time. In one of those plays was Peter Dinklage. So my first of many times working with Peter Dinklage was both of our one of our first shows in New York in the '90s. Frank Whaley, I don't know if you guys know Frank Whaley, another phenomenal actor. He was in that as well. So then what happened next was I did that, and at that time, Ethan Hawke was starting a theater company called Malapart Theater, and he was putting his season together, and the stage manager who did that show downtown, and one of the producers who did that show downtown, and Jonathan Mark Sherman, and several other people who were involved with that thing, were also working with Ethan. And he said he needed a lighting designer and called Ken Posner, which is exactly what he should have done. And Ken said he couldn't do it. And between Ken recommending me and like everyone else from this other thing recommending me, Ethan and I met. I remember the first time we actually met about his theater company, he asked me to meet him at a little cafe, in Greenwich Village, at the top of the village. And I could not find it. He was like, I'm like, what, like, where the fuck is this place? And I was like 20 minutes late. Anyway, he hired me to do his, I did three plays with them that first season and I think one other. And that's kind of how it all began. Like, that's how I started meeting people and then meeting people. That's sort of how it built. I met a ton of people doing the Malapart stuff. I met through another friend of mine who was a Malapart member, Nadia Najani, who's an actress, TV theater. She introduced me to David Warren, who was a director at that time, theater director, now doesn't TV. He hired me to do something, and then I was working with him for a long time, and some people saw some of my work there and hired me to do something else, and then it all sort of built on that. And New York City Film was another kind of avenue where that sort of took off also. Anyway, so it really sort of one thing led to another thing, led to another thing, led to another thing. Around the same time, the Here Art Center, in Soho, back then it was bigger. It was the entire ground floor before they cut it in half and just made one space. And they had three performance spaces. I was the lighting designer there for two or three American Living Room festivals, among many other things, where I met some people who did a show called Premium Bob, and that was another one of those like landmark for me experiences, where I got to work with some people who it was performance theater, it was performance comedy theater. So it was different. It wasn't like somebody wrote a play and actors were standing on stage talking. It was way more performance than that, performance oriented than that. And I loved every second of it. And so through the American Living Room, they would invite directors in to do short, either one act or short plays, several times, like 3 days a week would be a different show. Like, three nights a week would be a different show. And I met director after director after director who came through. And some of those people that I met way back then, like one of them runs the theater program in Rochester. The other one, another one, is Kevin Moriarty, who runs the Dallas Theater Center, who, worked there did a show at the American Living Room, and then went on to work like all over the place, and I hopped around with him all over. So I worked with him in Syracuse and Rhode Island, Trinity Rep. He ran the Hangar Theater and then went to Dallas. So then through Kevin I met tons of other people. So it really all all of these little estuaries, roots were built by small things here and there. The Kevin Moriarty thing. Sorry. The reason I just remembered, so the reason I brought Kevin's name up is because Kevin was hired to do a show at the Yale Dramat, a musical adaptation of a Shakespeare play at the Yale Dramat. It wasn't like that in particular wasn't the greatest experience. It was fine. We did it. It was fine. I actually think it was sort of infamous because the set collapsed and they had to shut the show down because there were a bunch of women dancing on a platform and the band was under the platform, and the platform collapsed. So
during a show,
during the show, like famously during, it was on CNN. So nobody got killed, but a lot of damage was done to musical instruments, and a lot, and everyone, like EMTs, like they all went to the hospital. So that was that show. So the producer of that show at Yale was a student named Alex Timbers.
Oh, whoa, my God.
Right. Which is how I met Alex Timbers. Then he showed up in New York.
And for those of you who don't know.
Yeah, I don't think many people will necessarily know who Alex Timbers is who's listening, but he's an amazing theater director. Does a lot of immersive elements in his shows.
Yeah, he has Moulin Rouge on Broadway, right? Well, prior to COVID. Right now.
He will again.
Yes,
he will again.
That will come back.
On Broadway.
But he does a lot of like little stuff too that was like really cool and before his time, and then now he's a Broadway director. But
yeah, yeah. And he did, so I did a little show at Ars Nova, one of the first shows at Ars Nova called Dixie's Tupperware Party that Alex directed, and through working with me at Yale, was like, I want that guy Jeff Kreuter to do it. And I was like, okay. And at that point, I didn't, like, no one knew who Alex Timbers was. Or maybe someone did, but I didn't. I was like, yeah, sure. I mean, I knew who he was from Yale, but I didn't know that he would end up being the Alex Timbers that we all know and love.
Right.
Mostly today. And after that, he was like, wow, that was great. I think we did something else together. And then he said, you know, I'm doing a three-week workshop lab of a new sort of play that I'm co-directing with Roger Reese called Peter and the Starcatcher. Would you come to San Diego for 3 weeks and hang with us and and work on Peter and the Starcatcher? I was like, yeah, absolutely. I would absolutely do that. Oh yeah, no, we did do something else between that. We did the first production of Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson.
You did the first version of that.
The first ever, yeah. And then for various reasons did not, lost touch with that.
I loved that musical. I thought it was super cool. Not many people did, but I did.
Yes.
But Peter and the Starcatcher was something really special.
Peter and the Starcatcher turned out to be really special. So Peter and the Starcatcher turned out to be special for a number of reasons. The reasons were that it was an amazing show where I met some people that I'm still very close with today, truly a family of performers, designers, and producers put that show together. We were out there, truly out there in La Jolla for 3 weeks putting this together. There were elements from that workshop at La Jolla that were unchanged in the Broadway production.
Wow.
Like there's a section of the first act that was lit and performed and staged exactly how it was, did not change. In fact, my introduction to Peter and the Starcatcher was Roger Reese acting out that section of the show for me in an office at Disney Theatrical Productions in Midtown Manhattan.
Oh my God.
That's something I'll never forget as long as I live. So what happened? So we were out there in La Jolla putting Peter and the Starcatcher together. And, at a certain point, like Disney Theatrical Productions relocated to La Jolla. And they were like just setting up tech tables all over the theater. And Michelle Steckler, who was at that time working with Tom Schumacher, set up their table. So she and Tom set their table up right behind my tech table. So there they are, like the people who are like, who were transforming Broadway especially at that point, it was still not, the transformation was not complete. Were sitting right there behind me, watching me light this show. So all that is to say, what happened next was I got a call from Michelle Steckler. The voicemail is still on my phone. She said, "Hey Jeff, we're here at Disney and talking about Newsies. And wondering if you'd be interested in talking to us about doing the lighting for Newsies." I was like, "Huh? Would I be? Yes, I would be interested in doing that. And I called her back faster than I've called anyone back in my life. And so, you know, and so Newsies is another, like the way I got Newsies was because of Peter and the Starcatcher, because I'd worked with the director on a tiny show someplace, and because I knew the set designer, and because it was starting at a theater out of town where I'd worked before. So if it weren't for all four of those things coming together, I would not have designed Newsies. And
well,
while Peter and the Starcatcher, yeah.
But, well, Tom Schumacher, who runs Disney Theatricals and is, you know, prolific in his own right for Disney, he was the reason we even met you.
That's
because
right.
We were like, we have this circus show, who should we have to light it? And yeah. He was like, oh, Jeff Corridor, he just did Peter the Starcatcher and Newsies, which were two of my favorite shows anyway, and the two shows that I actually remember the lights, like, surprisingly enough. You know, I'm like, oh, I really loved those lighting designs. And so also Tom was great because he introduced us to you.
That's right. So the branch of that tree all starts from because Kevin Moriarty brought me to Yale to do a crazy musical that collapsed and almost killed a band, where I met Alex Timbers, and that's how I met Tom Schumacher. So the answer to the question early that you asked early on is like, how does this happen? It just kind of branches out. It builds for me. It branches out. There was no one thing. It was a stepping stone to everything.
I'm so excited to use this time to educate people a little bit on lighting. And if you could just briefly explain, because you talked about having an associate and being that, like, what does a lighting assistant do? Like, what, how does that function?
And I guess what's the difference between a lighting assistant and associate?
Okay, so the quick answer to assistant associate. So associate is a higher up on the ladder position. They are oftentimes left with making artistic decisions that an assistant might not be left with. They're more hands on with the actual design. And if there are certain people who are assistants/associates who won't, like, you know, and to me it's just, you know, what's in a name, kind of, you know, at a certain point, you know, there are people who want the title associate. To me, it doesn't matter to me, what that is. And, you know, if there's an artistic input, if you're being in the room, I was going to say more important, but the assistant, like, it's all very important. But I guess the difference is tenure. I mean, I think there are people who have been in the business who are associates because that's what they want to be called. Also, on a Broadway show where you have several assistants, the associate is the one who's kind of in charge of all the other assistants. I think that's also accurate. And what that person does, so there's a lot of paperwork in the lighting biz. There's a ton, like, for all of these lights that are hanging up in the air, someone or a group of people needs to know how to turn them on, how they plug in, where they plug in, how to tell an electrician where to put them. And that's, like, key for me. That's what the assistant does. That's kind of the most important job for the assistant, other than the artistic part, which is really important, but to organize. Organization, paperwork, drafting, just not knowledge of the equipment to make sure that the vision of the show, whether it's my vision, the director's vision, or performer's vision, actually technically, like, from a technical standpoint, can actually happen. I'm not technically oriented like that. I don't, like, while I technically, like, you know, in theory, I know how to plug lights in and turn them on. I don't really know how to do that.
We saw you change a lens at one point during.
You did. You saw me change a lens. Right, that's right. You did. Because that's still, like, you know, I can still unscrew a light bulb. Because I also, you know, because I also know how to do things. I mean, I work on my roof. You know, I can actually fix things around my house. So yeah, when a lamp blew out at Beyond Babel, I was able to go up there and fix it. And I didn't have to. There were other people in the room who could have done it, but I was like, you know what? The right person, like, the electrician is the person who would actually do that. And he was not there and we needed it fixed. And I was like, you know, I'm just going to do it. Like, I don't want to ask anyone else.
But then it became a whole group effort. It was really a funny little moment.
Because we, yeah. Because how many people did it take to change a light bulb? None of us could figure out how to actually get it out of the light. So yeah,
that joke definitely comes from somewhere for sure.
Three people standing there with the manual being like, no, I think it's because this was a moving light. It wasn't a regular light. It was a moving light. It was an LED. It was an LED. Wait, it wasn't a light bulb. What was wrong with it?
I feel like it was like,
lens. Don't have light bulbs.
Yeah, one of the lenses, like the things that give the
cycles through.
Oh, a gobo fell
out. That's what it's called, a gobo.
That's right. One of the gobos fell out of the wheel, and we couldn't figure out how to, like, get it back in. But we did.
We did.
We won.
You did.
Technology. We did it. Okay.
So
now I've lost the whole phrase.
That's all right. I've got another quick thread I want to ask about. So having done dance, opera, circus, Vegas, New York, is there anything Broadway, off-Broadway, that's sort of on your bucket list of, man, I have not had the opportunity to like that? Maybe it's like the Olympics, or maybe it's something, I don't know, the Super Bowl halftime show. Is there something that, you know, you really are still have on that list of things you wanted to do?
It's out there, and I don't know what it is, but I know it's out there. There's not something that's on a list saying like, I really wish I could do this, but I have been so fortunate to have been challenged, at so many different levels of my career that, I know, that if, when the next one comes, I'll embrace it. You know, I did a TV show for the, you know, like, it wasn't a, it was a TV show, but they, it was this thing called, it was about the ballet. It was like what the ballet answer to Smash that show. What was it called? It was on Stars. Well, it was a weird one, but it was, you know, it was good. Anyway, so part of the TV show, there was a ballet. They were all, they culminated in them performing a ballet on a stage, and I lit the ballet for them. So I was with the whole TV crew. So that was a learning curve in a whole other way. You know, working Shakespeare in the Park was something different. The Big Apple Circus, totally different. Penn and Teller, different. So no, I don't know. I don't know what's next, but I'm looking forward to it. And also, you know, I'm not done working in the American theater. I think there's, I think there's more that I still love it. I mean, I don't even know why I said that, probably because I haven't done it in 2 months, but no one has. It's not like I'm retired.
Yeah. Well, how have you found like the 2 months, you know, since coronavirus hit, you know, productive? Are you able to feel like you're creating work or developing things, or are you using it for self-development? How are you using this time?
It's the aforementioned guitar playing. I'm back to playing guitar every day. A lot, like an hour a day sometimes.
Wow. Your calluses must be great.
Yeah. Oh my. Yeah. Totally. I'm becoming not a terrible guitarist. I mean, I'm not good, like if you took a real guitarist and put them next to me, you'd be like, oh yeah, no, you're terrible. But if you took an amateur guitarist and put them next to me, I think you might think I can play the guitar for someone who like is an amateur guitarist. I can do things that are not just like four chords, and I love it. And it's, and you know, when I stopped playing guitar originally, there wasn't really so much YouTube that there is right now. So what was frustrating to me is that I couldn't like figure out how to play shit I wanted to play. Now, if something pops into my head and I want to play it, I can learn how to, like, there it is. Like the lesson is there. And so it's kind of awesome. So there's that. I'm chopping wood, which I've never done before. I bought like
just to pass the time. Chainsaw.
Just because, well, they had to take down a couple of trees over here. So they were giant pieces of wood that had to somehow be dealt with. So instead of hiring someone to deal with it, I bought a chainsaw.
I was going to say, you look much more jacked than last time I saw you.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. I don't know if I'm jacked, but I don't know what I mean. I'll tell you that. And so, you know, there's, so I think you guys have started watching this Submissions Only, the series that I helped produce with my wife, Kate Weatherhead, years ago. There's talk about restarting that. So we've been doing a little bit of work on what that might be. There are producers now interested in doing it. If anyone else out there who's a producer who wants to do it, feel free.
It's a really funny show.
I was going to say, it's basically for anybody who's interested in like what it's like to be an actor in New York and that scene. It's an amazing.
Oh, yeah. It gives me anxiety because I'm like, oh God, I like, thank God I'm not an actor. Just
But it's got a bit of that, like, The Office kind of vibe, you know, for the theater world.
Maybe I've said this to you guys, but I'll say it for the public out there. So the submissions only started many years ago, and it started on the internet, and that's where it was viewed. Started on YouTube, and then went to BroadwayWorld.com for two more seasons, so three seasons total. And I remember pitching this, going into like pitch meetings, and a producer, like, you know, Kate Weatherhead, Andrew Kimballinger, and I were like, you know, showing it to a producer. And he said, "This is great. We love it." And at that point, it was like a 20-minute sitcom style show. He said, "This is great. Have you thought about, instead of doing a sitcom format, just doing like 5-minute clips? Because, you know, it's amazing, but I don't think anyone's going to watch TV on their computer." And then cut to, I would say, I think 3 months later, the billboards for House of Cards started going up in Times Square, and the world totally changed. So submissions only. Now I did not create the show. I was a worker.
You make a few cameos in the background.
I do, actually. That's right. I was in the background a couple of times. So was Tom Schumacher. He was in an episode, I believe.
It is fun to watch, because especially if you're a theater nerd, like, you see actors and people, and if you watch Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, there are a lot of actors from that show in submissions only. And I texted Jeff, I was like, they kind of play similar characters.
Yeah, I think the people who made that show kind of watched a lot of submissions only.
I think you can see kind of the inspiration.
So it's a great look. As you know, some people love that show Smash, and some people didn't. What I will say about Smash is that it might not have been a realistic look into what happens on the streets of New York if you're working in the biz, and submissions only is that. It is a very real comedic look at what an actor goes through to work in New York City. And, you know, it's not a documentary, it's completely scripted, but so many of those things are based on actual events.
Yes.
Like that episode where Kate is like in the reading behind the piano. Based on something that actually happened. So
they basically have her like sit behind the piano to read the stage directions, but she's also been hired as an actor. And so she's like behind the upright piano. You can't see her. And then she like stands up, and I was like, that would have happened to me if this was my life.
that something, it wasn't a piano, but something like that happened where they were behind a column.
I was like, just keep moving over to behind that curtain is perfect.
Well, yeah. Right. So we're talking, you know, we're actually meeting about that. And I've been doing this, this thing called Four Wall, Sunday Roundtable, which is a roundtable interview show where I'm the co-host and the producer, where we're getting people together who work in design or production. Or this next coming Sunday is editors and publishers of some of your favorite websites. Talk to people about how they're doing during this this shutdown. It's specific to what's happening now. It's not about their lives necessarily, unless they want to talk about what they're cooking.
Yeah.
But it takes a lot of time. As you guys know, it takes a lot of time to find people. It takes time to write press releases. It takes time to meet with the other producers. So that's been filling a huge void.
Well, I also saw maybe yesterday that Disney Plus now has Newsies on it.
I did not know that. That's great.
Oh, so I'm breaking news to you.
The musical version?
Yeah, the filmed musical version of Newsies is now on
that's
Disney
awesome.
Plus. You should check with your agent, make sure you're getting royalties.
I know, right? yeah, no shit. That'd be nice, since we all stopped making money a while ago. They started shooting some theater, which is awesome. So Newsies and Falsettos and Holiday Inn and Bandstand and the Pee Wee Herman Show are all kind of out there.
Yeah, hopefully we'll get
watchable.
To see.
So after you've listened to this awesome, awesome interview, go watch one of those videos. Put the art to the person contextually.
Yeah. I mean, Newsies was just like one of my I saw it maybe like three times, which I never see a show more than once normally.
On Broadway. The Broadway production. Yeah. It's great. I love that show. I loved working with those people. And it got, you know, what's funny is that it got, like, we did it again on tour, and then they shot this, and it got better every time. Every time we, you know, the next, so from Paper Mill to Broadway to the tour, we, you know, we all developed it even further. So it's exciting, very exciting.
So I think
what have we missed?
I was going to say, as we approach the hour 15 mark, I do want to get the three questions we get everybody answering. Okay. So here's the build up, Jeff. First question, has there been a piece of advice, either amazing or terrible, that has stuck with you? Besides, put your phone on mute before you do an
intro. No, man. Sorry. I'm going to put my phone on mute. No one, who texts these days? No, nothing's happening.
Okay, I know.
I should have done that. A piece of advice.
Good or bad?
Well, you're great. Okay. Like, be the nicest person in the room, which is advice I've not always followed. But here's better advice, though. I'm going to adapt that into something else. Never be the person that says no. No, the word no and the word try should be as far away from your vocabulary in the context of theater or performance as possible.
There is no try. There's only do.
Well, I will say, though, that I asked Jeff a lot of questions about trying lighting looks for Beyond Babel. Like, Jeff, what do you think about this? And you would never say no. You would just be like, why do you feel like that's the right choice for this moment? What do you feel like that's helping with the story? But it was good because you really made me articulate it. Yeah.
But that helps, you know, and this is to anyone who performs or anyone who creates, the more you can articulate, not even light, the more you can articulate anything that has to do with it will give a lighting designer or any designer a clue about how they can help you do it, how they can help you achieve it. You don't have to tell me you want something to be red. You can talk about, you know, you can say, I think this should be red and here's why. And I would, cause you know, like there are 700 versions of red. You know,
right.
So it's like, what does red mean? And where does red come from? And is it red on the background? Is it red? Is it red on your face? Is it red on your hair? You know, so anything to contextualize, helps us help you. So yeah.
Great.
So, it was so helpful because I also like clarifying moments, you don't understand really how to get there, but then when you talk about it and then you would be like, I really think that this would be good. Like, oh, that is what you have these designers at your, you know, on this project for to collaborate with. And it's so wonderful.
And for anybody who's particularly interested in the Beyond Babel lighting design, I will link this also in the bio. Jeff did an interview with Lighting and Sound America where he broke down with David Barbour, who's a journalist, the lights that we use, the different kind of looks. And there's photos to go along with that. That is kind of a nice synopsis of that process.
Yeah.
The second question of our three is for somebody who's a student, and in this case, probably a student of circus or dance or at least physical theater. Is there a inspirational movie or TV show or reference that you love that you'd recommend to somebody?
Oh,
it could be a book as well.
Submissions only.
Can't be your own work. That's the contingency.
No, I'm joking. That was a
this
joke.
This is Pierre the Starcatcher Bandstand.
Bandstand.
What was that show? The musical that was the Shakespeare that you did. That was like with Christian Boyle.
Oh, Something Rotten.
Something Rotten.
Yeah.
That was
a good one too.
Yeah.
I could spend an hour talking about that show and how I got that job. That was crazy. Can you ask me that question one more time?
So like,
inspirational to
we've just found that a lot of guests have a couple of either a book or something that they themselves, you know, love or was, you know, special to them. So just trying to pull out if there's an artistic reference you think you'd like to have people check out or that you would share.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the artistic references for me that are not lighting oriented were museums. I'm not sure this is a real answer to the question because I'm not sure that there is a movie or a book.
It could be anything. That's just any medium.
Yeah. Early on, it was specifically the Frick Collection in New York, where there are so many like beautiful paintings, and that paintings that depict light so clearly from from an artist's point of view. Like, you can see that a painter actually thought about what light means. And then color, like, you know, I love, there are a lot of designers who despise color, who just work in like shades of blue or like white and blue, and you know, I'm not one of those people. I appreciate it, and if that's the gig, if that's what we're doing, I can do that. But I like the way color plays, and I like telling stories using color and texture. So to me, like, art museums all over the world are, again, like, an incredible amount of inspiration. And anytime I work in a new city, I will find a way to get to the museum.
Have you, there's an artist now, I'm forgetting her name, but she paints these like massive color fields, and they're
she's got Boo Saville.
Boo Saville.
I don't know if I'm massacring her last name.
I don't know. I'm not familiar. But I'll have to check it out.
She's amazing, but her paintings were really expensive, so I copied one. I forged it and painted it on my own. But those color fields are really amazing because they're like, you know, a few colors that blend together, and it's all about like where they blend and like,
and what the colors are.
And what the colors are.
Yeah. I'd love to check that out. That sounds awesome. And also, like, there was a book called The Long Dark Tea Time of the Soul by Douglas Adams that is just like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So this is a non-Hitchhiker's Guide book. It's part of the Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency branch. And I don't know. I don't know if that was the first book that I read that I enjoyed because of the fantastical quality to it. And I, you know, yeah. I mean, there were a lot of things I read before that, but that was because it was funny. That's why, because it was fantastical and there was a humor behind it, and there was visual. Like, he told visual stories and made me smile throughout. So that's something that I appreciated also.
Great. Now Josh is going to add that to his Kindle.
Oh, for sure. And I love the Frick. So I'm doubling down on Jeff's suggestion. Yeah. For sure, go to the Frick.
Yeah, man.
See all those old Dutch paintings where, you know.
Yeah.
But I'll let Lindsay do the last one.
Yeah, our last one is a very open question. But who do you think would be interesting to have on the podcast?
Okay, this is a hard question, and full disclosure, this is my second attempt. They asked this question once, and I was like, this is too hard. There are so many people. That's why this question is so hard, because so many people flood to mind. There are a lot of people who I would love to talk to and just pick their brain and find out how they started and where they've come from. So, all right, so, you know, of the names that popped into my head first, Alex Timbers is certainly someone who is worth talking to. He has a lot to say. He's one of the smartest people I know. But I also, I'm not sure, I think his story has been told or is being told. And I'm not sure. I don't know. I absolutely think my wife, Kate Weatherhead, is someone who is worth talking to. She has done so many different things in the business of show and arts that anyone looking for inspiration about how to like invent yourself and reinvent yourself and reinvent yourself and go back to what you were doing when you started. Like, great, great talk there. But I'm going to say Rick Ellis, who wrote Peter and the Starcatcher. He's a fascinating man. I think the smartest person I know, and has done so many different things in this business. Every time I speak to him, I feel like I learned something and I'm highly entertained. He can tell a story like few others. And I can't imagine I think he'd be a great guest on your podcast. So Rick Ellis is my final answer.
Awesome.
That's a great, great guest. Yes.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for talking with us. This is so much fun. I hope people go after this and watch those things that are on the internet of yours so they can get a sense of it if they haven't already seen it live. And when Beyond Babel comes back and we restart, come see Babel and see Jeff and Sean's amazing design on our project.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great. I love you guys, and I can't wait to be in a theater or space or any open air venue, whatever it is, with you guys again soon.
I know.
My God.
Soon, hopefully. And
that was our interview with Jeff Croyder.
If you like our podcast, make sure to subscribe on iTunes, follow us on Instagram, Facebook friend us, Twitter tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. Enjoy your week.
See you on the next one.